From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, as the torrential rain pours again on Southeast Michigan, we'll talk about what needs to change to prevent massive flooding.
We have more evidence that, the infrastructure that we have is insufficient.
Also, we catch up on This Week in Michigan Politics.
They're putting an exclamation point on it. It's largely a form of tribal virtue signaling to show to Republican partisans that they're doing something, but the judge already did it for them.
And we'll speak with two cast members from the new Steven Soderbergh film, No Sudden Moves, which takes place in 1950s Detroit.
They had cars all up and down the street that were from that period, the costumes from that period. So for me, once I stepped into that house, I felt like, except for the crew, I felt like I was there in the 1950s.
Those stories just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we're going to review a week of news reveals and revelation, including the ousting of the Michigan GOP's executive director.
Political parties like the Michigan Republican Party, the Michigan Democratic Party, it's no insult to anybody that works there. They're just less powerful and less influential than at any time in history. And the simple answer for why that is because super PACs, Washington, D.C. funding, outside groups, dark money.
Stick around. We will dish the dirt in the second half of our show today. But first, the Biden administration has made a disaster declaration for Wayne and Washtenaw counties in the wake of heavy rains and flooding, which continues today. Michigan is not new to summer rains, even spurts of heavy rain. But the sustained pressure of these kinds of showers over the past several years is putting real strains on our infrastructure and leading to some questions about what upgrades might be needed to survive the change in our climate. Nick Leonard is executive director of the Great Lakes Environmental Law Center. He's here with us now to talk about this. Nick, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So what does the disaster declaration mean for people living in these counties and with the officials that are dealing with the lingering cleanup from the flooding?
So the disaster declaration basically means that there will be more resources coming to communities to help with all sorts of things, mostly it relates to responses to the flooding. So cleanups, helping people get back on their feet, that sort of thing.
What legal recourse do people have who might be running into dead ends as they search for help right now, either with their insurance companies, and we've heard a lot of stories, or asking FEMA for some assistance?
Yeah, so the legal recourse here is really tricky, and it's a problem, and it's one that's been around for a bit. So basically, if somebody wants to pursue legal recourse against an operator of a wastewater treatment system or a sewage system or somebody like that, they have to jump through a lot of legal hoops in order to do that. So they have to first file a claim with their local sewage system. And then once they file that claim, they have to make sure that they're doing it in the proper way with all the proper documentation. And they have to do that within 45 days of the flooding event. If they don't, then they're basically out of luck. They can't have their day in court. And so it's really important that people submit their claims, that people gather all the paperwork that they need, and that they do it in a timely way.
Nick, I wanted to ask you about something that's happening in Grosse Pointe. There's a group of residents that have filed suit against the city saying that officials were very much aware of the risks that flooding posed to infrastructure. Have you had a look at this case? Do you think they have a viable claim?
I haven't taken a hard look at it, but I think the case is certainly stronger now than it was actually 7 years ago in 2014 when we had a similar event in the same area. And so, at this point, I think it's hard for our water and sewage operators to say, like, hey, this was an exceptional event. We didn't know this was coming. We didn't know that this was going to be a problem.
Why do you say that it's a stronger case now than it was 5 years ago?
Well, I think because now we have more evidence that these types of rain events are going to be, more frequent, are going to be more intense, and we have more evidence that, the infrastructure that we have to essentially deal with these events and make sure that people's basements aren't flooded, that we're not polluting our waterways, is insufficient. You know, I think that what came out after this particular rain event was sort of the lack of infrastructure investment in our pumping stations along our freeways and their failure to remove water from our freeways and, as a result, the backup into people's basements. And so I think the more and more that you have these types of events, the less and less are the people responsible for managing this infrastructure are going to be able to say, like, look, there was nothing we can do.
Right. So let's talk about how infrastructure in our region should change. What are some of the top environmental and structural things that you can think of that should be on the agenda to fight flooding?
Yeah, I mean, it's really a couple of things. I think whenever you talk about this topic, you have to talk about both climate change mitigation and climate change adaptation. So mitigation being trying to, you know, reduce greenhouse gas emissions and mitigate sort of future negative effects associated with climate change. And then adaptation being, you know, getting ready for the changes that we're seeing now that we know we're going to see in the future, such as more extreme rain events. And so I think we need both. I think we've been starting to make some very slow progress on climate change mitigation and, you know, developing strategies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I think where we've really lagged behind is climate change adaptation, particularly here in Michigan. I think in Michigan we've had a sense that, oh, we're going to be immune from some of the more drastic impacts of climate change. We're going to be immune from rising sea levels. We're going to be immune from, you know, really, really extreme, you know, heats that make, you know, our summers totally unbearable. But as we're seeing it, we're not going to be immune from more frequent rainstorm events, and we're not going to be immune from sort of pretty drastic heat waves. But beyond just making investments in our infrastructure, also just sort of reexamining sort of the structures of our communities and making sure that they're resilient to those changes. And so I'll give you a couple of sort of concrete examples. I mean, one is obviously, you know, more investments in our stormwater and sewage infrastructure to make sure that, you know, we're able to pump water off of roadways, to make sure that, you know, we're able to treat all of the stormwater that's going to come with when we get, you know, 7 inches of rain in a very short, you know, 12-hour span. But also, I think beyond that, rethinking, you know, do we want to continue to invest heavily in sort of our freeways and things of that nature, knowing that, you know, they're going to be a risk when it comes to a climate change world. And so just doing beyond just infrastructure investments, thinking about how we can make our communities more resilient beyond just sort of managing more stormwater.
How could we make roadways more suitable for what we need right now?
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways. You can definitely incorporate more green stormwater infrastructure or GSI to try to manage runoff from those roadways to basically try to prevent it from getting into the sewer system in the future. But I think you also have to be looking at, you know, just less roadways. I mean, we have sort of a scheduled expansion of I-94 right now. We can't even handle the water that falls onto I-94 as it currently exists. And so, you know, there's definitely needs to be sort of the infrastructure investment, whether it's sort of hard infrastructure in sort of better pumping stations, more combined sewage overflow basins, stuff like that, or green infrastructure where it's things like bioswales and retention ponds. But I think we're at the point where we also need to start to rethink just sort of our broader projects in terms of, you know, transit development, community development, and think, you know, is this going to be climate resilient, or is this going to be something that, you know, is going to, you know, basically become non-functional due to climate change impacts, you know, periodically in the coming decades.
So what are some alternatives to expanding 94?
I mean, and this is something that we worked on long ago when this project was first proposed, but we said, you know, you should be looking at, you know, rather than expanding 94 to try to address, you know, traffic increasing traffic volumes and things like that, be looking at, you know, transit options, be looking at improving transit options in the region, and looking at improving non-motorized transit options. You know, those are things that I think, you know, are typically, you know, more resilient. I mean, I'm not even sure if the, like, portions of 94 are still closed. And I know, like, you know, I tried traveling the freeway, you know, even a week after the storm, and many portions were still closed. And so, you know, looking to those alternatives to, you know, make sure that our communities are more resilient and, you know, can function in the aftermath of these types of events. I mean, I think one of the big problems was not just after the our latest extreme rain event wasn't just, you know, oh, you know, people's basements flooded. I mean, that was obviously catastrophic, but I mean, essentially the metro area shut down. Like, you couldn't travel. You couldn't get anywhere. And, you know, that's a problem in and of itself.
Right. What do you envision as being the appropriate way to pay for this level of catalytic change?
Well, it obviously has to come, I think, from government spending. I think, and this is obviously a big conversation in the United States right now, is infrastructure spending in what it's going to be. And I think you see a lot of environmental advocates and a lot of environmental justice advocates pushing the message that investment in climate is an investment in infrastructure, and you can't, you know, invest in infrastructure without talking about climate. And I think, you know, this past couple of weeks in Detroit has shown that that's right. You can't sort of think about these things as disconnected. If you are, you know, you're making a mistake and you're not putting the dollars where they're going to be the most effective.
Nick Leonard is the executive director of the Great Lakes Environmental Law Center. Nick, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us on this.
Thanks for having me.
In just a moment, two actors who worked on the new Steven Soderbergh feature, No Sudden Move, talk about making a feature film in Detroit during the pandemic.
Like March 11th of COVID. So 2 days before the world was about to shut down. So I signed off on it and thought, I don't know if this is going to happen.
That's after a short break. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Last winter and spring, director Steven Soderbergh shot a film in Detroit. You heard that right, even as the pandemic was ongoing. The film, No Sudden Move, is now out in theaters and on HBO Max. It's a story about an ex-con, played by Don Cheadle, who gets roped into a criminal muscle job that is not exactly what it seems.
What is going on?
What's going on, big guy?
Yeah, what are we doing here?
We're following instructions. Are you helping me or are you not helping me?
No.
Sometimes when people lie, they tend to overexplain.
What made you think that you could trust me?
My guests today are two of the Michigan actors who appeared in the film. Catherine Banks played the role of Dawn Atkinson. She's a veteran of many Michigan productions and also teaches drama at Green Hills Academy in Ann Arbor. We're also speaking with Wallace Bridges, who played the role of Rudy in the film. He's a professor in communications, media, and theater arts at Eastern Michigan University, and he's also a Fulbright scholar. Catherine, Wallace, welcome to Stateside. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
Hi, happy to be here.
No Sudden Move opens on a pre-dawn street with Don Cheadle's character, Curtis Goines, walking, and it's interspersed with a series of black and white photos that pop up of folks in the 1950s. And just for the purposes of the story, we'll call them 1950s Detroiters. There's some family pics, black families, white families, kids dressed up for church, young couple and a baby, guys on a union picket line. And it kind of sets up the backdrop for how history, personal history, and history with the capital H are going to play a role in the story. It was really nice. When did you get the call about this film? Catherine, you want to tell first, and then we'll hear from Wallace?
Originally auditioned back in February or March, but I got my offer letter like March 11th of COVID. So 2 days before the world was about to shut down. So I signed off on it and thought, I don't know if this is going to happen. And then it didn't that spring. And I sort of sat around for a couple months with my fingers crossed, hoping that it would happen. Because to get sort of all of those people back in the room together. I wasn't sure if that was going to happen. You know, other people have other projects, things might get postponed, but it did. So I think I got the call, you know, then in September, it's a go. And from there, it was a big rush. I think from the time I got the call in September to the time I was on set, I don't know, maybe it was a week or two, but things happened very quickly once we picked up in the fall.
Wallace, does that timeline sound about right for you too?
Well, I think I must have auditioned for this film beginning around February and repeated auditions. They were pretty much virtual, as I recall. We video recorded ourselves and sent them in. And then the name of the film actually changed from February through about November or so. It had changed from Kill Switch to No Sudden Move. Anyway, I think I got the word that I was cast somewhere around November, probably.
Did you have any worries about trying to do this? I mean, we certainly weren't out of the pandemic when production started in Detroit.
They had a pretty good system in place. I believe I tested twice before I ever came to the shoot. And they had it separated in groups A, B, and C. And so I guess A might have been the actors and C might have been the crew or something like that. I got the impression that they were trying their best to keep people safe.
Yeah. Catherine, how about you? How were you feeling about it?
I mean, I was nervous, but I knew that there was a lot riding on this, right? So the stakes in a big movie done by Warner Brothers and HBO, like they need to get it right. And especially being one of the first films back, I knew that everyone was going to be, it meant a lot for the industry to get this movie up and going. It meant a lot to the industry sort of across the country. So I knew that people would be doing it right. And so because my scenes were actually shot over the course of a couple of weeks, regardless of whether or not I was working, I was in Detroit Monday, Wednesday, Friday, getting a COVID test. And then everything on set was very regulated in terms of masking and social distancing and fogging and wiping things down. It was intense in a way that made me feel really safe once I got there.
Mm-hmm. And they also put me up in a hotel. I don't know about Catherine, but they put me up in a hotel, I believe, 3 days before the shoot. So to sort of quarantine us.
Yes. Yeah. There was a bubble happening at the hotel that I was sort of a part of on and off because, again, my stuff was sort of spread out.
Yeah, it sounds like Catherine was involved in more scenes than I was. I was a day player and I shot one scene.
Yeah. Part of the fun of settling in for a Steven Soderbergh film is watching the opening credits roll and seeing all those names of the cool artists who we're about to see working together. Don Cheadle, Benicio del Toro, David Harbour, John Hamm, Amy Simons, Kieran Culkin. I mean, I've sometimes thought that Steven Soderbergh should just stop making movies and just throw parties or something. I assume that there's something similar going on with his production and crew choices. I mean, he's great at ensembles, but you'd miss it if you weren't looking for it. But the work is a lot more one-on-one on this film. What differences did that mean being on set?
Yes. You know, because of COVID, even though the cast was small, yes, the scenes were smaller. And so the crew was really pared down. We weren't in a studio. Everything was on location in houses from that were built in the early 1900s, not these big open floor plans. So everyone's shooting sort of in small rooms and small quarters. So there was a small amount of people there to do a job. And so everything was very, even though we're talking about a huge movie with so many people in it, the scenes themselves were really intimate. And I think that was actually nice. It was able to really make connections with the people that you were in a scene with because there weren't so many eyes on you, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Making a movie with so many ensemble players work can often be about timing and mood. Can you tell us about what you saw the directing team doing? Or, I mean, I know you weren't really able to watch everything being shot on set, but things that you were aware of that Soderbergh and the production team did to try to help both those qualities of timing and mood come off as they should. Wallace, did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, first of all, we shot our scene in a house in Hamtramck, and it was a very small home, two-bedroom, tiny. We were crammed into this this living room, basically, with the crew. So there are just three actors, but there were probably four or five crew members in the space, all kind of like crammed in there. everything in that house was dated from the 1950s. It was, they had cars all up and down the street that were from that period. The costumes from that period. So for me, once I stepped into that house, I felt like, except for the crew, I felt like I was there in the 1950s.
Yeah. Catherine, how about you?
As an actor, you know, several people had sort of given me the heads up working with Stephen, that he really lets actors do their own thing. He trusts them to make their own choices, or maybe he just trusts himself to be able to edit it all together at the end. But in terms of performances, there's a lot of freedom. He doesn't really fuss with what you're doing. You know, I think he's really great at getting the right people in the room together and then letting them do their thing. As far as the, you know, setting the mood and the tone and, you know, what was going on the art direction side of things, it was really amazing being in those houses. And all of my scenes were shot in Rosedale Garden, which is a neighborhood on the Northwest side that I know well, right? So I grew up in Redford, and my grandmother basically lived on the other side, for those of you who are from Detroit. And so being there, it just really took me back to that neighborhood. So even though I was growing up there in the 80s and 90s, it made me realize how much of my grandmother's house was still stuck in the 50s and 60s, like the window cranks, the cookie jars, the pictures of kids on neighborhood ponies. It all really was authentic to my childhood and what I knew about the generation before me and what was happening in their houses and their lives. So it was all really wonderfully familiar. So, you know, I'll share, my grandmother would have been my same exact age when I was filming in 1954.
Oh,
and
wow.
I wore her dress to my audition. So there was a lot about, you know, thinking of pictures of my grandma in 1950s Detroit and, you know, for me channeling that into my performance.
That's amazing. If you're just joining us today, my guests are Catherine Banks and Wallace Bridges, actors who are featured in the new Steven Soderbergh film, No Sudden Move. I want to talk some more about that period and how the film draws on Detroit's specific history, but maybe this is a good moment to just have each of you explain the parts that you played. Wallace, tell us about Rudy.
Right. So Rudy apparently is married to Kurt's old girlfriend, and Kurt returns to see her, Clarice, to pick up the suitcase. And apparently Kurt's history, he just got released from jail, and Rudy does not approve of Kurt, nor does he approve of him coming over to see his wife. So basically, Rudy tolerates Kurt's presence and wants him out of the house as soon as possible.
Right. This is a way of reflecting what, you know, what Kurt's community might make of him at this point in his life. And Catherine, do you want to say a little bit about Don?
Sure. So Don is the best friend of Mary Wirtz, who's sort of the show's leading lady. She is a 1950s housewife, sort of living in the constraints of that time. And throughout the movie, she supports Mary through a very difficult time. And, you know, I don't want to say too much, but we sort of learn about the deep intimacy between these two women as the movie goes on.
How did both of you see this film? Were you able to go to theatrical releases, or did you see it through a link, a screener link?
I saw it at a friend's house on HBO Max.
Like you do these days.
I went to the drive-in event in Dearborn. And so I saw it. Yes. So I saw it with a bunch of other people for the first time, which I usually like to watch my work alone. But I did. I went with my husband. And we saw it on the extra big screen at the drive-in. It was a lovely sort of 50s themed event. So I saw it there, and then I did watch it again at home, which is my preferred method.
Sometimes filmmakers rather famously get things wrong when they put a city to film, and that's especially true of Detroit. How do each of you think that the team did with portraying Detroit in the film? Catherine, could you go first?
Sure. I thought it was great. Having watched it twice now, I personally haven't caught any non sequiturs and being there. You know, again, I sort of touched on this earlier, but I feel like I was really taken back to my childhood growing up in that area. It was a real treat to sort of be working on my home court. Like, there's so many details in the set dressing that were familiar to me. And I know that it was really important to Steven to actually film in Detroit. They looked at other locations, but he really wanted the authenticity of the city.
Wallace, how about you?
You know, based on historical photos and such from that period and around in and around Detroit, I thought they were right on with their setting, with their costumes.
Some local writers have been laying on the praise to No Sudden Move for getting all those visual qualities true to form. And it really is. It's amazing. The art direction and all aspects of that are really beautiful to watch. But I wonder if there's also something here about how people are with each other in Detroit. I'm thinking of the pretty casual attitude people in the film take toward race, even when they're being casually callous about it. Do either of you have thoughts on that?
Race. You know, the idea of race didn't strike me very hard from this film. It seemed like it was not really about race. So for me, it didn't jump out at me. I did not see the film as a film that dealt with race.
It examines a period in Detroit history when, I'm not going to say the playing field had been leveled, but, you know, the city's communities were on a different footing because of the prosperity that the auto industry had created in Detroit in a way that maybe they hadn't been before.
You know, I think there is a practicality to folks from the Midwest that's particularly heightened in Detroit. And so, you know, as the film sort of touches on the leveling of the Black Bottom and Paradise Valley neighborhoods, right? These thriving middle-class Black neighborhoods that in the film, I forget the exact year, but I think one has already been razed and one's about to be. When you hear characters talk about it, there's a very matter of factness to it, right? There's a sadness and an anger that's bubbling underneath and maybe motivating folks to take the next step. But you're right, you don't see a lot of explosive reactions. There's a lot of matter of fact talking about things the way that they are.
Yeah. Can I ask both of you just how you've been able to put things together for yourselves during the pandemic? You both do a lot more than just act, but I'm just wondering what kind of year it's been like for you in terms of the parts of your work where you need to be with others. Catherine, do you want to go first? And then I'm curious, Wallace, how you'd answer that too.
Sure. You know, I think a lot of my answer will echo most people, right? So I'm an actor and a teacher and a parent. And I have been stretched to do work at home that I never thought could be done at home, and finding new ways of connecting with folks online. And also when we're called to be together with this film or, you know, other small projects I've had coming into the studio, I think people figure out how to do it safely, because we're so hungry now, right? We're so sort of starved to be in the same room together that I think people are doing what they need to do to be safe. So we can, you know, artists want to get back in the room together. And so they're taking all of the safety precautions very seriously.
Wallace, how about you? I know that a lot of what you've been immersed in most recently hasn't really been dependent on production companies or stage work per se, but it's been such a weird year for everybody. What's it been like for you?
Yeah, pretty much at home, nearly 24 hours a day. I was teaching in March of 2020 on campus, and of course we moved online. And I have been teaching online since 1998, so that was not a big adjustment for me, but it was for some students, especially in light of the restrictions and the shutdowns and that, where I was starting to see that there were some students the second that we went into the lockdown, or like a week within we went into the lockdown, there were a handful of students who I noticed that they were sort of not able to cope with that. You know, their work failed and they were just having difficulty. Me personally, I like to be around people. Yeah, I like to talk, I like to hang out and all that. So that was very limited. And I've been working on this documentary, and frankly, my wife got tired of hearing about that. Because she was the only one I could talk to, right? And so she got tired of hearing about that.
I want to thank you both so much for telling us about your year. We've been talking today with Wallace Bridges. He is featured in the new film No Sudden Move as Rudy, and Catherine Banks is in the film too as Dawn Atkinson. Wallace, Catherine, it's a pleasure. Hope your year this year has a lot more opportunities to be in person.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Elsewhere in the news, it's been a bit of a week in Lansing politics. We'll break it down after a short break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Is this the aftertime? We ask ourselves this question when we go into stores and maybe see unmasked folks walking toward us, as we go on vacation this summer and revisit the things and people we haven't seen for like 18 months, and as our work lives change for what must be the 400th time since March 2020. Here's the big question, though. Is it the aftertime in Lansing? We have now weathered the storms of pandemic politics, election 2020, and the anti-government feelings that brought insurrectionist crowds to Michigan's and the nation's capitals. Are we beyond these things, or are we in a new time informed by them? We welcome back today Adrian Hemond and John Selleck to talk about the week's news in politics. Adrian's the co-founder of Grassroots Midwest, the strategy and advocacy group, and John Selleck is the founder of Harbor Strategic Public Affairs. Guys, happy summer. Welcome back.
Hello.
Thanks.
I want to start out today with executive power. Unlock Michigan is a Republican-led effort to overturn Governor Whitmer's use of executive orders to guide public health along during the pandemic. And these orders, as everybody I think is aware, are at the heart of the friction between legislators who wanted fewer restrictions and more consultation from the governor as she was issuing orders, and Governor Whitmer herself, who felt that the circumstances of COVID called her to act and act fast to curb COVID. So the way this worked is Unlock Michigan gathered enough signatures from the public to enable the legislature to vote on a repeal and thus bypass the governor's authority. Sorry about that long explanation. Adrian, do you see this as a long-term win for Michigan's Republicans?
Not exactly. It's kind of gilding the lily. They already won in court on this issue. So, I mean, the policy victory was already done. They're putting an exclamation point on it. It's largely a form of tribal virtue signaling to show to Republican partisans that they're doing something. But the judge already did it for them.
I don't know about this. I mean, it certainly seems possible that we could get into a period this fall when the pandemic numbers might get bad again. John, do you see Governor Whitmer as less likely to try some form of executive order, if that is the case?
Absolutely. I don't think she has abandoned the cause of public health, but I think we've seen that she is doing everything possible to at least be seen as getting out of the restrictions business. She doesn't want to put any more restrictions on. She's trying to turn and pivot. I mean, we kind of like gone back in time. I feel like we're watching a 2019 version of a Michigan governor who's out doing press conferences and making promises to their base and distributing free money to everybody that she can. This is like the old ways, and she wants to stay that way because we've even seen recent polling that showed that her approval rating, and this was done by a Democratic firm, I can note a national one, her approval rating specifically on her COVID response is down to 51% positive. And while we can argue that's a thin majority, it's much lower than what it was at some time in the past. And maybe that's indicative of people's frustrations and exhaustion. They're ready to celebrate and party. And as you said in your intro, we're seeing a lot of people out and about doing things and trying to reestablish the enjoyment of their lives. Governor Whitmer's not interested in getting in the way of that between now and her reelection date.
I guess part of my new understanding of politics in, I guess what I'll call the aftertime, is realizing how much more pandemic timing may play a role in the political process, John. Like, is it possible that the Republican Party, having gone after all these goals to, you know, repeal executive orders and try to undermine what Governor Whitmer was trying to put into place, might shoot itself in the foot if things go bonkers with another variant?
you know, we've seen indications that they're about to start what amounts to a Unlock Michigan Part 2. Well, they'll go after the second law that the governor was using, which was the public health code, to do those kind of restrictions. And sure, we could get into that. I mean, frankly, it's so obvious still that the potential for the Delta variant or any other pandemic explosion later on is the biggest variable between now and the election by far in our entire lives, let alone politics. And that's just something that is just hanging there outside. But we're even seeing Governor Whitmer make sure that she turns the corner while she can get out of the Capitol, get out of that press auditorium in the Romney building, and go out and do positive things for as long as possible. Cross your fingers, you're going to get to be talking about all this free Biden money that you're spending to invest in Michigan's future instead of what do we have to do to be on lockdown again.
Adrian, do you think that local officials across Michigan are any more likely now to impose their own health restrictions like mask mandates and lockdowns than they were at the outset? I'm thinking of places that might be a little purplish, you know, maybe parts of Macomb County. I mean, Oakland County seems to have taken its position. Like, what has Michigan's experience taught us about executive powers for public health?
You know, I do think it's pretty unlikely that many purple jurisdictions anyway are going to implement a lot of public health restrictions going forward unless things get really bad with COVID. Obviously, a lot of that is dependent on continued vaccinations and reaching a level where it's harder for the disease to spread. I think in general, John's right that, you know, people have started to grow worn out from a lot of COVID restrictions. And that's entirely understandable. I mean, human beings are social creatures, you know, having been denied a lot of forms of socialization, they're ready to get back and resume some of their normal lives. Most people seem hungry for some amount of human interaction and human contact. And so I think certainly elected officials are going to be very reluctant to impose new restrictions. But if things get bad enough, you may see local public health departments feel like they have no other choice.
Yeah. You know, if I could go back to something that Adrian said earlier that he's right about, he has far more creative terminology than I about gilding the lily here. For Republicans, this is not the Republican Party that's running on the excitement of cutting taxes or reducing regulation. You know, the old school stuff, the actual conservative policy, I think they're faced with sort of two options. It's let the big lie election issue run wild and be the controlling issue inside the party, or use the executive powers issue when it came to public health be the issue and that make the fight about Governor Whitmer and not about President Trump. And I think that's why you see the legislature ready to go. And I think the Senate passed the Unlock Michigan issue yesterday. We'll see the House do it next week. They would rather be fighting the election on the turf where Governor Whitmer exists, not what happened back in 2020.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are John Selleck of Harbor Strategic Public Affairs and Adrian Hemond of Grassroots Midwest. Glad you brought that up, John. This week, Jason Rowe, the director of Michigan's Republican Party, so like the functional operations officer for the party, stepped down. He was someone who had acknowledged last year that Joe Biden did indeed win the 2020 election. And he also wasn't really reluctant to say that he felt Donald Trump's actions were what cost the party that. There wasn't a false narrative of corruption among Michigan cities. John, do you know Jason very well? Can you tell us a little bit more about him?
He has a great reputation first that extends back as a legacy. His father was a leader in the Michigan Republican Party, actually ran it in the town where I live in Brighton. He was closely connected, his father, with former Governor Romney, that he picked Brighton to be the place where former Governor Romney is buried. He was that close to the governor, his family was, and that steeped in Republican politics. And he's had his own career in Republican politics. So when he came back to Michigan, a lot of people thought it was probably a great thing to have him be over at the party. He's certainly a qualified political operative who's had a lot of success in his life. You know, yet for that one quote that was in Politico, he'd probably still be sitting at the party. He'd be quietly having that fight that he was ongoing with. But that quote was there. And that's all it takes right now. And this is a party that is, some people are certainly true believers. They want to run anybody out of the party who disagrees with President Trump. And then some people, like a lot of politicians, look for an issue they can jump onto to raise their stature and raise their level within their own political party. And we're seeing that. That's not just for office holders. That's for members of the grassroots, too. So they're using that issue to kind of raise their own stature in the party. They're holding that scalp up in the air to say, hey, we got rid of a rhino, quote unquote. And it helps elevate them at the same time they think they're carrying out the mission for the president. But overall, I would make an argument right now that political parties like the Michigan Republican Party, the Michigan Democratic Party, it's no insult to anybody that works there. They're just less powerful and less influential than at any time in history. And the simple answer for why that is because super PACs, Washington, D.C. funding, outside groups, dark money, the state political parties have never been weaker in their ability to affect elections. So certainly Governor Whitmer's team and LeVar Barnes over at the Dems are celebrating the dysfunction going on over at the MRP. But really, those entities are at their weakest point average simply because of the sheer amount of money that will come from other places to affect the election.
All the same, it's not as if candidates can run in a void. Adrian Hemond, can you think of anyone who could square the circle at this point and both, you know, stay true to the kind of Republican issues that have formed the party's platform in the past and also appeal to Trump voters?
No, I don't think that's possible because what it means to be a Republican is changing. That's been going on for a while. You know, Donald Trump only accelerated that. But a lot of these, what used to be red meat conservative issues that John was referring to earlier, those aren't the things that motivate the base anymore. The base is not motivated by tax cuts anymore. You know, they're largely seem to be motivated by the grievances of the former president. That's not a great model for them going forward as a party, but someone who tried to run as a Mitt Romney sort of conservative, a Jack Kemp sort of conservative, really at any level, if they're open about their views like that, they're going to get clobbered by the base because that's not what the base wants.
Hey, one last question, you guys. It's raining again today, and Michigan is on the cusp of trying to decide what to do with a huge pile of federal cash for infrastructure improvements that President Biden and Congress have finally and just barely agreed on. It's been so long since Michigan had the capacity to make this kind of investment. Do we really know how to do that kind of huge project anymore?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, we have plenty of expertise to do large infrastructure projects. You know, we have very skilled trades labor force that can do that sort of thing. And the fact is that, you know, it's not as though big infrastructure projects haven't been happening in Michigan. They just haven't been happening at the pace that you need to maintain or even improve the infrastructure that we have right now. So I certainly think we're capable of it. I think potentially the more interesting question is, you know, what is going to be the impact of the continued federal largesse here? There are enormous amounts of money sloshing around in the economy, and there's about to be a lot more with this infrastructure package, potentially even more if the Congress can pass this reconciliation package through the Senate that's being discussed. And that's going to have some pretty wide-ranging impacts for the ability to get infrastructure projects done as inflation continues to rise because of all the money sloshing around in the economy. But it's also going to drive up consumer prices, and that's going to have potentially some political impact at the state and the federal level.
John, we may have the talent to do a major project, but do you think that Michigan still has what it takes to get the political consensus to agree on something that would truly be transformational?
Right. I think that's really the key question, April, and it's great that you asked it. And I'm pretty skeptical about that. I think that the ability for the two parties to agree, the governor and the Republican legislature on something, includes infrastructure. All sides want to see infrastructure improve and get better. And certainly any politician loves it when the money comes from somewhere else. So you don't have to raise the money, you just have to figure out how to spend it. But the political environment of working together is just not there right now. So that's a significant issue. There's so much money. And it's going to take time because of term limits and things like that. The people who are sitting in office now may not be there to see it through. So I'm skeptical about the long-term ability of not only the projects to be selected in a cooperative way, but for them to be seen through to the end. And frankly, there's just so much money. It kind of reminds me of the floods. There's so much water. You don't know what to do with it. I hear stories all the time of there's so much money filtering down to locals that they're like, whoa, I just found out I have, you know, $500,000 grant. What can I do with this? That's a side effect of where we're going to see money ended up being wasted. We're going to end up seeing some stories coming out saying that that money didn't go to the right place or didn't really serve a specific need. And in the end, that just then circles back to create more cynicism about government's ability to manage those things.
John Selleck of Harbor Strategic Public Affairs and Adrian Hemond of Grassroots Midwest. Gentlemen, lovely to hear your voices. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks a lot.
At the very end of the pinky of Michigan's mitten sits the Woolsey Airport. This place is named for an early aviator whose actions in the 1920s inspired his father to donate the land to create an airport. This week, a historical marker went up to tell their story. Interlochen Public Radio's Kendra Carr reports.
Clinton Woolsey grew up on a dairy farm in Northport. He was the youngest of eight children and was the only boy, says his grandniece, Lynn Contos.
And so I think he was probably slightly spoiled and allowed to do whatever he felt like doing. And one of the things he felt like doing was trying to make his own gunpowder out in the barn. And I don't know if he blew up anything or if he got caught before that happened, but he was always interested in things like that.
An interest in how things work took Clinton to Valparaiso University, where he earned an engineering degree. After college, he joined the military, serving in the National Guard. It was 1916. A few years later, when he was sent to Camp Taylor, he was introduced to planes.
Fell in love with planes when he saw them, and so that was kind of all they wrote. He just, from then on, he knew that's what he needed to do.
Planes hadn't been around that long. The Wright brothers flew their first plane near the turn of the century. Clinton was such an early aviator that his pilot license was signed by one of the Wright brothers. In 1926, Clinton was called to participate in the Pan American Goodwill flight.
The Europeans were making inroads into South America, and they wanted to be able to build up the U.S. influence more. And also, they wanted to establish what they would hope would be commercial routes to South America for commercial airlines, which didn't really exist at that point.
That's author Tom Wilson. He helped the family do research on Clinton for the Historical Marker. 10 experienced pilots were selected for the Goodwill flight. Wilson says Clinton was likely chosen for his military service and engineering experience. The flight to South America was dangerous. Not only were internal combustion engines not really reliable machines at the time, but
no weather prediction like we have today, so you were just sort of looking out into the sky and hoping that the weather wasn't going to turn bad on you.
There was no radio communication, so pilots used hand signals.
You were flying an open cockpit airplane, so you were, you know, being battered about by the wind.
And as if that wasn't enough, because the planes needed to be able to land in water, the engine was upside down. Regardless of the challenge, Clinton and his co-pilot, along with four other planes, took off. It was December 1926. They were going 85 to 90 miles per hour, and the journey was a 22,000-mile round trip. 2 months into the journey, something went wrong. On February 26th, they were preparing to land in Buenos Aires when a gust of wind caused the plane Clinton was piloting to collide with the wing of another plane. The pilots from the other plane were able to pull their parachute and float to safety, but Clinton had a dilemma.
Clinton's co-pilot was out on the wing because they had discovered at a previous landing that they had a problem with their landing gear. So he was trying to manually lower the wheels so they could come in for this landing. So when all this transpired, his co-pilot was out on the wing.
The plane was crashing. Clinton could either pull his parachute and abandon his co-pilot to certain death, or he could try to land the plane without the wheels and his co-pilot still on the wing. He decided to attempt a landing. They both died in the crash. Clinton was honored posthumously with the Distinguished Flying Cross, and his father, Byron Woolsey, lost his only son.
I think he was so devastated. That's what made him think of getting this airport to honor his son.
That's Lynn Contos again, Clinton's grandniece. Shortly after Clinton's death, Byron had the idea to create an airport in his son's honor. He then donated the stone creamery he built himself and 80 acres of his dairy farm to Leelanau Township for the airport. The township was so excited by the proposal, they donated an additional 120 acres to make the Woolsey Airport a reality. It's still a working airport with two runways. And now, a historical marker is being added to the site. On one side of the marker is Clinton's story of the Pan American flight, and the other side shares the history of the Woolsey family and dairy farm. Getting this historical marker means a lot, Lynn told me through tears.
So amazing.
I'm Kendra Carr.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. Hope this finds you high and dry. We'll be back with you on Monday.